Joe, how are you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. I have been evacuated this week for the sixth time, but the evacuation was lifted yesterday morning. And this particular time, I didn't leave, as I mentioned to you before the show. And my wife and I were able to, we were here by ourselves in Montecito. And so we just broke into people's homes and stole stuff. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding, Tim. We didn't do that. Well, okay, maybe we broke into Oprah's house, but no, we didn't. We just stayed at home, but we did take some walks, and it was very strange because, you know, it was raining, and that was the reason for the evacuations. They were afraid of debris flow rolling through town. But it was just the two of us, and it was kind of interesting to be in a, you know, sort of a regular American type town with buildings and houses and stores and things and no one around. So
like an episode of it's like an episode of Twilight Zone or something.
It was, yeah. It was exactly like an episode of Twilight Zone.
So you went and looted all the shops. Of course, the answer to that is more welfare programs, more education, and more dialogue.
Well, have applied to the Rockefeller Foundation to have our entire town reworked as part of the New World Order.
The foundations, that's what we're talking about.
The foundations, yeah.
The great foundations. So, of course, the great foundations, of course, we're talking about Ford, Rockefeller, Carnegie. There's other ones like Guggenheim. Of course, now we have the Gates Foundation. There's the Packard Foundation. They all seem to be reading from the same script or following a similar agenda. These foundations... I guess they originally established, I think, as public relations and also as a tax dodge. But, of course, the income tax was passed in 1913, and it is the plutocrats, it is the elite that made sure it got passed, and they don't really pay any income tax. So, really, they don't really function as a tax dodge primarily. So, not a tax dodge. What are these foundations for? Now, here we have the Ford Foundation. This is from Wikipedia. The Ford Foundation is a New York headquartered foundation, globally oriented private foundation with the mission of advancing human welfare. Created in 1936 by Edsel Ford and Henry Ford, it was originally funded with a $25,000 gift from Edsel Ford. So, and the Ford Foundation is the fifth wealthiest charitable foundation in the world. $11.2 billion is its worth, $12.4 billion endowment. Of course, then there's the Rockefeller Foundation. Is a private foundation based at 420 Fifth Avenue in New York. It was established by the sixth generation Rockefeller family, of course. The foundation was started by Standard Oil owner John D. Rockefeller, Sr., along with his son John D. Rockefeller, Jr., and the senior principal oil and gas business and philanthropic advisor Frederick Taylor Gates. That's an important name. In New York, this is in 1913. Of course, its stated mission is... promoting the well-being of humanity throughout the world. So you really, and then there's the Carnegie Corporation, established in 1911. And of course, their mission is to promote the advancement of diffusion of knowledge and understanding. The Carnegie Corporation has helped establish and endowed a variety of institutions, including the Carnegie Libraries, National Research Council, the National Russian Research Center at Harvard, Children's Television Workshop. So I guess you can blame Big Bird on him. I don't know. Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, of course. The Carnegie Foundation for Advancement of Teaching. The Carnegie Institution for Science. More recently, we've had the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, also known as the Gates Foundation. It is a private foundation, of course, founded by Bill and Melinda Gates. It was launched in 2000. The primary aims of the foundation are globally to enhance health care and reduce extreme poverty in America, to expand education opportunities, into access and access to information technology. I believe it is endowed with $44.3 billion as of December 31st, 2014, according to Wikipedia. So these are these foundations. They all want to help humanity, expand education, improve healthcare, provide libraries, promote the arts, culture. So I'm reading their mission statements. I don't see how anyone can be opposed to these foundations, Joe. So why are you so critical of them?
Well, gee, if they were actually trying to do any of that stuff, the world would be a perfect place, wouldn't it? Everything they touch seems to turn to crap. If you actually, you know, go back and study the effects of the programs, I'm going to just talk for just a few seconds about, you know, so people can get a flavor of the background of the foundations, of one of the foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation. And I'm going to focus on a guy named Jerome Davis Green. He was the first secretary of the foundation, and he's the one who actually wrote the what's called the principles and policies, okay, outline of it. You know, he was from the Forbes family. He was, you know, the grandson of General William Maxwell. If you look at his family, they're just, you know, high-ranking U.S. senators, Supreme Courts. So he's a plugged-in guy, right, from the very beginning. Brahmin, Freemason family. He graduated from Harvard, and he became the secretary to the Harvard University's president. So you can, you know, get a flavor as to what this guy is all about. This was, you know, he started then connecting into Wall Street, and that's where he joined with John D. Rockefeller. And so when Rockefeller set up the foundation, he made Jerome Davis Green the secretary. And now the thing that illuminates this guy completely so that everyone can see who he is, excuse me, is that he was also a member of the Round Table, which is the infamous secret society founded by Cecil Rhodes. And this was basically, you know, you have, he was a very high-ranking member in the organization. And so here you've got Milner, Walter Lippmann, George Beer, and, you know, the round table criteria. And they then set up the Council on Foreign Relations. Okay, so this is what I wanted to focus on, is that you have the, first of all, the linking up of the foundations, right? They are actually very related because they all have just one purpose. We'll get into that. But you can see that since the secretary and the author of the principles and structure of the Rockefeller Foundation was actually a member of the Rhodes Trust, the Rhodes, the so-called round table with Milner, that, you know, knowing what is clearly, you know, understandable about the round table, you can see that this is basically a secret society. It's involved in every infamous act of history, you know, in the whole beginning part of the 20th century. And yet here this guy is right in the middle of it. So when then you go down and you look at all of the things that, you know, that this is, that these two groups have been involved with funding. And I'm just going to focus on two, so because, you know, there's a dozen of them, we're not going to go into them. But both the World Bank, right, is funded through the Rhodes Trust and the Rockefeller Foundation and the Council of Foreign Relations, as I mentioned. So this is, you know, not some kind of altruism. You know, the Council of Foreign Relations is a secret society that links together politicians, military, and banks, right? That's what it does. The World Bank has never created any debt that was capable of being paid back. It's just another division of the IMF. It creates debt for the purpose which it genders. It creates out of thin air, basically. It doesn't really have any funding mechanism other than just the creation of credit that's given to it by central banks that get their money comes out of thin air, and then voila, the debt appears in some third world country and now they have to pay it back. Okay. So the world, through the foundations, have become more and more enslaved, right? They use the financial tricks and, you know, through the debt to do it. But of course, through the Council of Foreign Relations, they also get into the actual process of the political structure of all the different countries. So when you see the foundations as the financial core of these things, right, then what they are becomes clear. And really, you know, Tim, your description of them as altruistic and how they represent themselves to the public, I mean, to me, this is just a mirror of Freemasonry, where you've got all of the different ways and levels that they are able to get people to look at the organization as something that is benign and altruistic. But then when you look inside things like, you know, the Opium Wars and the creation of Zionism and the Nazi Party and the political classes, you know, that are being set up, you can see that really it's an organization that's intent on world domination and just doesn't give a damn who it kills to get there, right? It's just the opposite of altruism. So with the foundations, I mean, all you really have here is money that has been structured so that it doesn't have to have any taxation or kind of interference from democracy. That's really what the foundations were set up to do, is just to circumvent, you know, democratic observation of what was going on with the money. And so, you know, at one point they were very, very in motion in terms of what I see as the, you know, New World Order slave plot. But they've become less relevant over the last 20 years because there's so many different sources of funding now. You know, you talk about Bill and Melinda Gates, but, you know, as a new player in the foundation world. But you have to remember that the foundations, I think, are almost irrelevant because the finances now have so many dark pools. You know, you have people have calculated that there has to be some kind of plunge protection capacity inside of the U.S. political system, financial system, in order to keep the stock market at certain levels. And that the whole bond buying, you know, there are times when China dumps $100 billion in U.S. treasuries, but the interest rate doesn't go up, doesn't make any economic sense. How can that be? Who's the buyer of these bonds? And so basically a number of people have calculated and concluded that there is a black pool of money now. So in other words, the influence of democracy is fainter and fainter as time goes along. And the deep state now has access to its own method of funding. And so I think that the foundations are actually, you know, like the public secret societies like Bohemian Grove and Skull and Bones are basically being replaced with, you know, new technologically focused systems of money and wealth creation and political power that will basically eventually replace them. I think the foundations are, have always been for evil. But as you go forward, it's hard to know really what they're going to be involved with. I mean, I certainly don't trust Gates and his foundation and his relationship to vaccines and all sorts of creepy things. But I also think that because there has been, you know, a kind of ratcheting down of the observation of the public, of the democratic public into the workings of government, that the usefulness of the foundations is probably going to be coming to an end pretty quick.
Yeah, it's certain. They were very important back in the 20th century. as far as moving culture along under the guise of philanthropy, manipulating the culture. Under the guise of philanthropy and charity, these families can leverage their wealth to come in and take over things like education, culture, and move it in a certain direction, like promoting modern art at the expense of, you know, classical art. Just by their patronage, they can defund artists and sort of snuff out the talent pool or drain the talent pool or stifle the method by which people perfect their arts by patronizing people like Jackson Pollock.
I was just going to bring him up somehow. He came to mind.
Yeah. So there's that, and there's a lot of the mission is social alchemy, and the foundations is the tool they use to carry out the social alchemy. There's an interesting I'm reading G. E. Michael Jones's book John Cardinal Kroll and the Cultural Revolution, and the foundations played a big part in the Cultural Revolution. I think you and I both talked about this, you know, promoting creeps like Kinsey. Using their, of course, when you talk about the foundations, also tying into the publishing houses and the artists or poets or public intellectuals they select for us that we're supposed to admire and emulate. But he's talking about, of course, in this paragraph, he references Rene Worms' book, Foundations and Their Power, a book written about the foundations, I think it was written in the 1950s, about the Reese Committee investigations of the Carnegie Foundation in particular. But this is what he writes. Rene Wormser, Reese's legal assistant throughout the hearings, this is during the Reese Committee hearings, documented in a book published in 1957, this is what I just referred to, not only the dangers posed by the foundations to the institutions of the Republic, but also the influence those foundations and their political allies were bringing to bear on the nation's cultural institutions. The great foundations, Ford, Rockefeller, Carnegie, were for the most part founded as a result of the New Deal as an attempt to prevent the flow of family money into the coffers of the federal government under the tax policies instituted by Roosevelt. Created from the wealth of this country's major capitalists, the foundations soon applied the techniques of the cartel and the trust to the flow of information and the reconfiguration of culture. The foundations would put up money which would serve as venture capital in the politics of change. Foundations like those run by the Rockefeller brothers would fund projects like the Kinsey sex surveys, which would have been otherwise impossible to support given the constraints of a democratically elected government or simple satisfying the market forces. The foundations would fund research which they found congenial, and this almost invariably involved instigating social change away from a position of congruity with the moral law. They involved more often than not, as the Kinsey studies did, the substitution of scientific data for moral principle. And then, scientific, of course, in quotes. And then, when the project had received a modicum of public acceptance, the foundations would turn the funding of the projects over to the government. This was by and large the mechanism of cultural revolution in this country. The foundations would fund the undermining of some law, generally having to do with sex, the family morals, or religion. The courts would remove any legal roadblocks. The press would proselytize to whatever the social change entailed, giving widespread dissemination to the scientific surveys, which the foundations funded. And eventually, the government would set up programs based on what the foundations proposed, funded by government money. The government's involvement in contraception is one instance of this general rule that we will examine in greater detail later. But I thought that was a great summation of sort of the modus operandi, or how they carried out the social alchemy. All looking very scientific, also looking as if it's all independent, but it's all a closed circle, very Masonic in a way. Wouldn't you agree?
It's a great summation. I love that. That's exactly right. I mean, you can see how they were used with that summation, is that they would fund like Albert Kinsey. I mean, here is someone who is just a complete crackpot in terms of his science, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's literally nothing there scientific. But he received enormous money in order to run around and to create bogus science, which then was tied together with media stories, which are also benefiting, and often oftentimes from relationships to the foundations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so now you can see it's a closed system, that that what you have is the power of reification. And that is a word which means the propensity of the mind to see something is real if a word exists to describe it. Right. So in other words, since there is a word to describe both the Carnegie Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Kinsey Institute, and then the magazines, right, which then, you know, wrote glowing articles about the sex genius in information that Kinsey was putting out. The mind, as it looks at the names of the different organizations and the different individuals and the different ways of viewing these things, it thinks there's a whole herd of, you know, different points of view that have all concluded that this is something that is really wonderful, you know, for our culture to change in this direction. Sort of like feminism, you know, is another example of this. But when you then step back and start to deconstruct all of these different things, you can see that the reification was just artificial. In other words, what they do is they will create different organizations precisely to create the idea that there's just all kinds of people that really think this stuff is wonderful.
Yeah, they create the sort of the illusion of a heterodoxy. There's a consensus among these differing people, and they're the smart people. How can so many people, smart people from different fields, agree on one thing? It must be right. And in reality, they're all being manipulated, and they're all funded, because they're all being funded by these enormously wealthy families through the foundations, endowments to universities and stuff. That's these foundations endow universities and decide who the academicians are. That's one of the revelations that came out in the Reese Committee hearing. It's covered in Renee Worms' book on the foundations. Norman Dodd, the chief investigator, one thing he found out, you know, when he sent the investigator, Catherine Casey, to read the minutes of the Carnegie Foundation, she found this plan to collectivize the country largely under the pretext of war. And another thing was the fundamental manipulation or changing of how people are educated in this country. Through the Carnegie Foundation, they were charged with handling international education. But the Rockefeller Foundation took up the effort of fundamentally changing domestic education. Of course, that goes back to the early 20th century, because I think back in 1902, Rockefeller gave $180 million to the General Education Board. And that's mission was to slowly collectivize education, turn it into, you know, impose compulsory education, impose oppression school system to create workers, not thinkers. And you have what's that quote from Frederick Gates, who was a business advisor to Rockefeller? It goes something like, in our dreams, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hand. The present educational convention fade with our minds, and, unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon the grateful and responsive rural folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or of science. We are not to raise up any of them authors, orators, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for the embryo of great artists, painters, and musicians, nor will we cherish even the humbler ambition to raise up from them among them lawyers, doctors, and preachers, and statesmen of whom we have ample supply. So they're, again, there's looking at society so they can be molded and manipulated to their purposes. And some people I've heard some people try to excuse that as saying, well, they're talking about, you know, poor rural country schools, and they're just trying to give them a helping hand, and they're trying to improve them. Well, yeah, fine. If you buy that, if you look at these people as benevolent or charitable, okay, fine. But no, I mean, obviously, what's in that remark is utter contempt for the dignity and humanity of the common man.
Sure. I mean, I would just also note that that in back of all of the self-disclosures is what is really being hidden, and that is that they're concentrating political power.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you talk, they talk about collectivizing education, the Prussian school system, you know, and they say, well, they're trying to develop workers because they want better workers because the oligarchs have money as the, you know, the object. Now, that's really not the real purpose. The real purpose is to reduce people's kind of capacity for rebellion and self-reflection. And it isn't to make the oligarchs money. That's just a the money is only something that they use as a tool to get to the goal that they're really trying to achieve, which is complete world domination, which is to say a slave state, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why the Rockefeller Foundation both funds public education with the idea of, you know, collectivizing it. It creates the, you know, the PhD system in the United States so that it can ratchet down on any kind of independent thinking. And then it also takes over basically nutritionally based medicine and gets rid of it. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, all of these things are, you know, you could say, well, the Rockefellers wanted, you know, to create chemicals. And so they wanted to make more money by getting rid of the nutriopaths and they wanted to make, you know, students be more organized so that are more obedient, so they can make better widgets, so they can make money. Look, money is not the goal. The goal is slavery. And the reason why they wanted to, create the current medical state is because they want to ratchet down the intellectual power of the public. That's what the medical system does at this point. And it also is a form of birth control. Mm-hmm. You know, so they're both depopulating and creating, mentally and politically feeble individuals. That's what's in back of all of these activities. And it's I don't know if it's the if it can ever be a point of information that someone can understand who hasn't come pretty far down the path to a free mind. It's very hard to start people with that understanding. You know, it's almost you have to start out with more banal, you know, conspiracies and information sources about the secret society than to get to the conclusion, which is, look, you're basically being made into a delta. Your children are going to be epsilons and everyone is going to be slaves. And I mean, literally slaves. You know, you're just going to be told what to do. And if you have any kind of disobedience, your self-driving car will just explode.
Yes. That's so interesting, because it was according to Norman Dodd, when he sent Catherine Casey up there. Catherine Casey said, "Why on earth would I investigate the foundations? Because they're dedicated to doing good. These are venerable institutions." She just believed that. But then, for some reason or another, the guys up there gave her full access to the minutes. And apparently, when she returned, her eyes were like, "Why?" You know, like. Her eyes were wide open, I guess you could say, if eyes wide shut, and she couldn't believe what she had discovered, and her worldview had been shattered, and she eventually had a nervous breakdown. She couldn't handle what she had seen in those minutes. The actual dictaphone recording of those minutes was apparently destroyed. They lost them. Should have been part of the congressional record. The Reese Committee hearing. The Reese Committee hearing was hamstrung all the time, and by the establishment press, by other congressmen. One congressman named Wayne Hayes played a pivotal role in shutting down the investigation. These things. So there's a lot of strings were pulled to shut down the investigation. One other thing we mentioned, education, was that they found that the Guggenheim Foundation had been created to take over the historical scholarship. And they created the American Historical Association with a $400,000 grant, pretty much picking 20 young historians to be the establishment historians and marginalizing some of the independent historians like Beard, Charles and Mary Beard. They apparently refused the offer. But they said, well, it's fine. We'll just ignore you and start paying historians with these chairs and endowments, and they'll know what they have to say. And that's how they took over the historical profession. This, of course, this shapes our worldview of what happened and what is. And it's the largest function what these institutions create, whether it's the CFR, which is a sort of a coordinating body between, you know, government, corporate, journalism, entertainment, to create a worldview, to create an arena in which we all must play. And we can fight it out in this arena, but we all must be in that arena. And that's what they're doing. They're creating certain... Well, it's basically, you chuck it all up to, it's sort of a grand perception management.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. They it's like a, you know, a matrix, which, it, you know, the, now the Wachowski sisters,
yes,
are created, you know, this film, so people could kind of see what actually is taking place, is that their minds are just basically, all of the data has been, you know, arranged or as best that the oligarchs can, so that you just have an understanding of history that makes the real goal of the people who are orchestrating it invisible. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really what is happening, is that, you know, it's sort of like, you were saying that how they will basically coordinate different, you know, groups to create this idea of consensus. And then you have intimidation. I mean, it's sort of like 911, which is, I always think, is the, you know, good starting place. Yeah.
Or Operation Mockingbird is one that was revealed.
Operation Mockingbird. But I mean, 911, it's like, well, you know, you have Geraldo Rivera stating it's not an inside job, and then also Popular Mechanics.
Yeah.
You know, and so, wow, I mean, how could it possibly be? Because, look, both of these different sources are giving you this information. And so... the public, but that's a very easy to understand, overt sort of example of it. But in fact, all of this stuff is manipulated in different ways, because, you know, when you control the media and when you are very clever in terms of the science of socialization, you just have a lot of options. You've got a lot of things you can, you know, bring to bear against the public.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, another element, of course, another element, or guess first let's talk about some of the malevolence of these, the malevolency of these foundations. A great example is, Bill Gates himself, Mr. Microsoft, the world's wealthiest, one of the world's wealthiest men. He has taken on, the problem of disease and food shortages in Africa. And he made a speech, this is back in 2010, I think, at a TED Talk in California. And the speech was titled, Innovating to Zero. Okay. Sounds great. So he was talking about, you know, all the stuff about CO2 emissions, the environment, and anthropogenic global warming, all the talking points. And all the concerns of overpopulation. And he said something like, Gates said, first we got population. The world today is 6.8 billion people. That's headed up to 9 billion. Now if we really do a great job on new vaccines, healthcare, reproductive health services, we lower that number by perhaps 10 or 15%. Now, we live in an Orwellian world where reproductive health services is now abortion. So it's the opposite of reproduction. But but we lower the population by 10 or 15%. So in plain English, you know, this guy was clearly stating that his vaccines were going to reduce the world's population.
Right. And I don't know, I'm sure that, you know, he could give a really, you know, kind of weasel language, you know, kind of way of saying that he meant something else. You know, he meant that, you know, this would be all part of this improved health system, which would have birth control as part of it.
And yeah, and educated women having less children.
Educated women. Yeah. I mean, this is another, you know, yeah. Yeah, let's go to this red herring. But, you know, the thing is that, you know, the whole population bomb, and the baby boomer, notice the, you know, derogatory, mm-hmm, kind of mind control, mind shaping ideas about population from the very beginning. is fake. I mean, you know, if any of this stuff was real, we'd all be starved to death long ago.
It wasn't the Club of Rome, which is funded by the Rockefeller Foundation.
there it is. You know, the Club of Rome was saying, you know, $5 billion and you'd have the starvation. And now, you know, it's the 50% more than that. And they're, you know, people are still, you know, basically able to feed themselves. So it's, you know, so they just they always want to keep the pressure basically to depopulate certain groups. And the groups, you know, that have been the most focused are the Japanese and the European. Mm-hmm. You know, now, why is that? Well, that's really what needs to be exposed. But certainly those groups have been basically evaporating since World War II to today. You know, they have a very, very, well, and they won't go into all this stuff, but we've talked about it so many times. And, you know, the fact is that these groups have been focused upon, they are being genocided, and it's a deliberate act. And so when you get to the foundations, you know, they are funding sources for the bogus science and the bogus journalism and the bogus political forces that are all working to bring, you know, world domination to this small group. There really isn't much more that can be exposed about these things. That's just really what they do.
Yeah, I remember the ABC news report from about maybe 9-10 years ago, where Oprah Winfrey was meeting with the sage from Omaha. What's his name? Warren Buffett. And Bill Gates. And the news reports treat him like, what are they meeting for? And it says and they play the theme to the Super Friends, the cartoon. And they're almost like Super Friends. They're meeting just to solve the world's problems. And that's it's just completely puff piece on these yeah. people, and they're meeting to solve problems: healthcare, women's healthcare, vaccinations, hunger, and apparently, you know, as if Oprah Winfrey has any idea about how to help people. I mean, she's dedicated to you know, depopulating, getting rid of black people. She wants to have less black people. How is she a
very strange individual? Yeah. And a homie lives right down the road from
yeah.
me. I can actually see her house. I'm one of the very few homes that can, because she and I are neighbors. And as I've said, you know, people have, like, I just wanted to back up. People always ask me that when they learn that. They go, well, what did I do to, you know, make this enormous wealth, you know, that enabled me to be neighbors with Oprah? Well, first of all, you know, basically her garage is like 10 times the size of my house. So that's one. But the other thing is, I moved here to this neighborhood long before any of the celebrities did. I've been here for 33 years. And I was, you know, I thought it was a great place to live and I wanted to have kids. And so that was really what caused me to stretch the budget and try to afford to live here. But I could never afford to, nor can any human who isn't engaged in illegal activity move to this neighborhood now, because, you know, now it's been completely, you know, pumped up by all of the different, you know, criminals and, I mean, you know, Al Gore's wife, all these people are all, I mean, the list is endless, you know, people who've come here. So but this wasn't the way it was when I came here. It was completely different. And so now, you know, you wonder, about Oprah. You know, she's in our community, she's seen as someone who basically creates charity. Mm-hmm. And that's really how she's looked at. She's beloved because of her charity activity. And she doesn't do a lot of it that I'm aware of. Of course, I'm not in the donor class, so I don't really know these things. But when she does, man, she can really deliver the punch. You know what I mean? She's got a lot of bucks. And so when she does something like that, then the public just basically, you know, we'll see her as someone who's a heroine, and they would never question, you know, any of like, how did she become, you know, such a powerful person?
Yeah, what does she have to offer?
Yeah, what is it about her talk show that's even interesting? You know, it's just kind of amazing. But it's just like Bill Gates.
Yes.
These things are creative. There must have been, I mean, I'm just going to speculate that there had to have been some, kind of Masonic agreement in terms of her career that she entered into way, way, way back. I mean, even before she was that terrible actress in The Color Purple, I mean, she had to have had some kind of connection into the oligarchy. Maybe
she's like she's a distant relative to the Queen of Wakanda.
I mean, I've never actually spent any time with her, but I'm going to ask her if I get a chance to. But the thing is that it goes, and the reason I was bringing that up is that this course goes to Bill Gates, who has, in my opinion, a completely fake story.
Mm-hmm.
It's just 100% fake. There is no way IBM would have ever, under market conditions, have given the creation of the operating system for their PC to someone who couldn't write code and didn't have an operating system. I mean, this is just the most ludicrous story in the annals of world business. And when you look into his family background and you see, Planned Parenthood, mm-hmm. and state banks, then you can see, well, wait a second. Obviously, this was a secret society decision. And remember, we talked about the power of reification, and so they didn't want IBM to be Microsoft. They wanted to rebrand because if you recall, IBM was seen as sort of Big Brother.
Yeah.
And Microsoft and Apple were the rebellion, the young hip kids. So
revenge of the nerds, yeah.
Revenge of the nerds. And so this was what was going on. They were trying to fool the public into thinking something new was occurring, right? Because they had a new name, Microsoft, Apple. It's a brand new name, and, so that has to be something new. But, in terms of Gates, anyway, there it's clear that it was fake. That this was just they were going to, create Microsoft. This had been the plan since MK Ultra and the personal computer and going back who knows where, but certainly to the Macy conference. So they were going to use all these things for control, for world domination, and the foundations then. Were once again used as part of the process. Now you've got Gates with his seed bank and vaccine programs,
mm-hmm.
right? But they certainly look nefarious to me, very suspicious. And given that the money is coming from, it originates with this completely fake business relationship that just, just screams that secret society. Then we know that the foundation is corrupt too,
So. Yeah, and perversely, Bill Gates or even a character like Oprah Winfrey, they'll have a certain amount of credibility with the public, moral credibility, oddly enough, because sure. they've established their bona fides, their success in the business world or in entertainment, and now they have so much capital that they've banked, they can be used to promote this agenda, and Bill Gates has done that, of course. You mentioned his father's connections to Planned Parenthood and all this. So these corporations can promote this agenda. The same thing they did with the whole Silicon Valley scene. In fact, this is to say the whole thing's a stage. These people really are living these lies, but they create a certain Silicon Valley culture, which is then promoted. In an odd way, it's sort of a permissive libertine culture. That has a certain amount of appeal. This also has a certain effect on the culture itself. About again, like the same way that celebrities or rock stars do on the culture, changing morals and these things, and so they create this image of a freewheeling nerd, sort of a cross between a nerd and a hippie down at Silicon Valley, and they're
right.
and all promoting a certain lifestyle, and also this whole techno geek stuff where instead of they worship technology and. They pretty much sacrifice everything at the altar of technology. Now, who does that serve? Well, that serves the scientific dictatorship, because something as archaic as the Fourth Amendment. Well, we can't let that hold back, you know, technology, worries or concerns about privacy or the Bill of Rights. No, because we worship technology, and efficiency is king, you know. So, you know.
Well, I wanted to, since we're kind of broached into this, and this actually will is part of our theme because it leads into Bill Gates, but there's a video that I would hope people would look at. It was shot in the 1966 festival, which was before the Bean, before the human Bean, there was a thing called the Whatever It Is Festival. And it was filmed, and this is clearly one of the, you know, beginnings of the creation of the counterculture. It's the video is, you know, it has, it's almost laughable. This, the people who are explaining what they're doing, and you can, you know, someone who's sensitive can easily understand that, you know, what you're looking at is artificial, and that this is all going to lead up with, you know, the psychotic drug LSD being given to, you know, all of the kids in San Francisco's streets. This was because this and the fact that it was in 66 before, you know, the this culture really became, you know, implanted. You can see that this was, you know, who the people are and how, why they are deliberately bringing about. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because it has an incredible interview with Stuart Brand.
Mm-hmm.
And Brand then becomes part of the Silicon Valley, you know, movement, which leads into the Apple computer. And he worked with the guy who developed the mouse, right? And Stuart Brand is there, and he both dances and then gives an interview. And I would point out, if he's in a white jumpsuit, you know, very Masonic kind of outfit, and his dancing, I mean, it's he's just trying to portray a zombie, you know. I mean, there's just nothing at all about. It doesn't look like he's enjoying himself. He's just there, you know. Look at him when you see him dancing, and this is a way that he's getting people to behave in this way. But then when he comes for the interview with the San Francisco KRON, he's wearing his top hat. He just happened to find a tap hat somewhere, so he has a white jumpsuit. White and black, you know, and he has his top hat on, and it's the most and he gives an explanation as to why, you know, people are behaving this way, which is just, it's just completely ludicrous. And when you know in hindsight that this guy was part of the group that's going to bring about the counterculture as a, you know, as a way to basically culturally debase people, it's just as clear as a bell. And the fact that then Brand, you know, and the whole way that that technology then, as something that is basically hip and cool. Remember the whole Earth catalog that Brand bought out, and then the he actually then developed the expression personal computer, mm-hmm. right? And so when you see this in 1966, you really get a great you know, picture as to how then the Gates Foundation would, you know, also link into this, you know, in a strange way. And it was that was posted by Zoz.org, ZOS.DOTORG, who is really Steve Outram, the entrepreneur mm-hmm. who knows an awful lot about Silicon Valley. And I just would highly, it's on Facebook. I don't, you know much about Facebook, but Steve or Zoz cited my name in his citation about the video, and so I'd hope people would see that, because this is, like, I think, a really important, you know, visual thing to understand the counterculture, and then it leads right into the foundations, because, you know, you have the wealth that is being created by things which I think are in fact artificial: Apple, Microsoft, you know, now Tesla. Amazon, they're kind of reflective of the way that the foundations operated. And I think that's really going to be, you know, in the 20th century, the foundations were kind of at the heart of the fake research and these social structures. But I think now you're going to find it's going to be deep state, you know, kind of alphabet soup, military and government intelligence agencies, working with fake corporations, you know, like Microsoft, like Tesla, this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, because you can execute a lot of social change once you concentrate the economy through the corporation, just through human resource policies.
Well, exactly. And see, this
no free speech in a corporation, right? Because they can fire you. Got,
exactly. You see, and so this is how they're going. This is part of the process by which the world becomes, you know, basically a slave camp, is that these fake corporations then will they'll be where the jobs are. And that's how they can have much more direct control over, you know, the population. And of course, they'll have the monitoring capacities with Facebook, with, you know, the various computer technologies. And then they're working hand in hand with you know, the fake government, and so this is really, you know, our condition.
Yeah, I mean, especially with occulted finance, because they can direct capital or credit to favored companies, and they can squeeze out competitors with a black hole economy or black money. What's the prices? How does an honest company compete?
It's like Amazon. I mean, Amazon loses money every year, and now it's becoming the most important corporation in the world.
Yeah, how do you not ever post a profit and grow?
Well, where does the money come from to fund the growth? You know, I mean, basically, the only way that the growth of these companies can occur is companies like Tesla and Amazon is if they get some kind of artificial funding source from the government.
Yeah.
So that's why one thing I'd love to see is a real forensic audit of the funding sources of the companies that are going to be part of the technological slave state. Because I think you'd find, if you really got in there and looked, you'd find that that a lot of the money comes from basically government grants and dark pool money. And of course, from the foundations, because you see, I think what we're looking at is a transition. I mean, you know, Freemasonry, you could see that it was the focus of the plot at one point. It was used to gain control over the royal families, but then as the you know, as they were able to reduce populations and to set up financial domination with the world wars, the civil war, you know, running the armies into each other, creating debt everywhere that had to be paid back. They would, you know, be the owners of the debt. So now they can transition into, you know, because the government is reliable at this point. It can't be seen by the public. I mean, what does Tim Kelly know about what goes on inside the NSA?
Yes.
You know, or inside their surveillance system, right? I mean, we don't know anything,
or the Federal Reserve Board.
But it's the secrecy that was set up through Freemasonry and the secret societies that is then reflected in the Federal Reserve, which is now part of the deep state's ability to monitor us. It's one system of secrecy, one system. And in back of the secrecy is malevolence. It is they're heading toward a slave state, and we have a few points where they've made mistakes, and we can actually see fingerprints. You know, it's like the MK Ultra pay requisition for Gordon Wasson.
Yeah, that was just on my mind. The Life magazine with the Macy Foundation, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that's a good example of there are numerous examples with the Ford Foundation. The Ford Foundation often provided cover for CIA and funded projects through the foundation. Other foundations have done this as well. But the malevolence of this, and also just the long-term planning behind this in culture manipulation. I mean, your work on that with promoting the drug culture in the 1950s.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, we can see how you know, they are expanding their powers, their technologic powers. I mean, if you want to understand the Great Schism and what the counterculture is really about, the counterculture was really just to make people basically want to enjoy sex, drugs, rock and roll. It was like an archaic revival to focus on these things so that the technology side wouldn't be something that people would be worried about or focused upon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, basically, the partition between the deep state's technology and the slave group is just growing greater and greater and greater. And now with the vaccines, they can start to basically take the group that is to be enslaved and start ratcheting down their intelligence to so that they can be absolutely positive there won't be any rebellion, you know. And so now they're making the autistic normalized.
Yes.
Because that's probably the IQ range, or it's in that zone that they really want to take the remaining populations, you know, of the slave group. And then, of course, this will be combined with robots, you know, that will do most of the stuff. But the human population that is enslaved will simply be reduced to the autistic. And so, you know, this is, you know, I think an honest appraisal. And I think it's call to action. I mean, I think we should really try to resist this. Not much of a future for our kids. And so everyone should, you know, who is on the, and I would say, Tim, this is how, like, people ask me, they go, well, how do you know who is like in the secret society? I go, look, you don't need to know that. You only need to know if you're not in it. That's all you need to know. If you're not in it, if you don't know about it, then you need to fight against it. You need to expose it and to try to resist it. That's all you need to know. And we need to make sure that we don't let the fake dialectics and the real dialectics, if you look at the groups that can resist the enslavement, there's all different kinds of people. You have, you know, Catholics, you have atheists, you have, truthers, you've got, libertarians, you know, you have all sorts of Jeffersonian Democrats. I mean, you've got all kinds of different groups that, if we're given the choice, would rebel. But they are fighting among themselves. It's sort of like, you know, the alt media, the different individuals who are, you know, kind of known, so often end up fighting each other rather than trying to create unity between different groups that can actually do something. Now, I know, you know, one response is, well, you know, I have this unique truth and everyone else is a limited hangout. So I have to, make sure that they are the ones who are exposed first. But then if you look at the trajectories of these people and you go, well, how many people have you been able to get into your camp? You know, and they have like 50 people or something that follow them and basically are, you know, that isn't a, you know, an organization that's going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We need to find a way. When you look at look at how the foundations operate in terms of media, Tim, that's the kind of power that we need to generate. We need to have that same kind of ability to get information on a broad scale and then have a number of people step forward and corroborate it. And even though when the oligarchs use this technique, it's BS and they're just mind controlling, here we'd be trying to do it in exactly the opposite reason. In other words, if you look at like my position on Christianity, it would not be the one that E. Michael Jones would have.
No, I don't think so.
No, we would probably argue. But
nevertheless.
So what?
Yeah.
I mean, this to me is not a grounds that we can't agree that we're being enslaved and destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't, on my part, a reason to see E. Michael as someone whose energy I would want in any way to affect. It's just the opposite. His Catholicism is working wonderfully for him to go through and find the truth. And so this is something that I want to support, even though, yeah, I wrote Caesar's Messiah. But I also know that, you know, if when you write works like that and you do analytic technique into, you know, government propaganda, you end up with a horrifying understanding of reality. And when I look at someone like E. Michael Jones, what I see is someone who is an ally. And so that would be, what I would say, that all of the alt media should take this to heart, is that we can find lots of stuff to fight about. Who cares about this? It's irrelevant. What we really need is what can unify us? What are the things that we can actually grow a movement with? The foundations, they have the money, and you can see how they operate and how they were able to infect culture. Well, Tim, we have the truth. We have an understanding of what they're doing. And so that has to be our currency. That has to be, how we can create a foundation, even though we don't have any money, that will have some power.
Yeah, well, yeah, maintaining a lie is much more expensive than telling the truth.
Yeah.
So they have to have on several orders of magnitude, you have to have those resources to maintain, this mountain of lies they've built up over the
years. You have to buy Popular Mechanics and yes. Then also control Fox News.
Yeah.
So you can then CNN. I mean, you can see that it's just this. The whole system, as you say, it's expensive and it's complicated, and that's its weakness, That's its strength, of course, because it does basically become the Matrix. But the fact that you have so many balls they have to keep in the air, and they all have to keep secret. In other words, think about it. If the truth about Fox News was ever exposed and the whole public understood it, wow, there'd be the grounds for rebellion. Same thing true with CNN.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing that's true with Popular Mechanics and individuals, like Geraldo Rivera and, the 911 government narrative proponents. All of them have to be maintained, basically. You can't have any one of them just step forward and become believable. So it's to the public in opposition to the mainstream narrative. So there's a lot of opportunity, for us to find and expose and disclose.
Mm-hmm. And like I said, the information is out there for anyone willing to read, put a little time into it, and the connections are all there, how this stuff has been coordinated. So many lies have been exposed and so many false stories that the mainstream media, the universities, these things should have no credibility whatsoever to any halfway informed person about these things. But nevertheless, people are still beguiled or entranced by authority, and particularly the professional class, high IQ people who are very intelligent, but they're very, very subservient to authority, largely because their relatively lofty positions is based on that authority. They have the law degrees, they have the medical licenses, they have the PhDs in these things. And if you wander away or you get off script in any of these issues, you find yourself immediately unemployed and not going to cocktail parties anymore. And you won't be able to support your pay your mortgage payment or keep your kids in college. And you'll find yourself ostracized. And that's what the decision people have to make. What matters more? Is it truth or being popular or being accepted? And I guess this is just the fate of humanity. Most people want to be accepted, and
boy, that's so true.
Live
Tim.
A quiet life.
The more they have gone up the ladder, particularly of the university to law degree or PhD, some kind of degree that works in their financial world, and they have success based on it. I mean, how can they really rebel from that? It's very, very tough because. I've never seen anyone, give up his Ferrari.
Yeah.
I've never seen anyone say, well, I'm going to, not live in a $5 million house and be, go back to living, in a $1,500 a month apartment. I mean, that just doesn't happen. It's just such an enormous change of perspective, That's why the rebellion is going to have to come from the poor. And fortunately, the oligarchs are creating so many of us that we have a nice pool to choose from. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be more of us going forward. But the disadvantage of that, of course, is that, when you're poor, you don't have the energy and resources to actually create a rebellion. What we need to do now is just create information, create a schematic, a history that people can see and make sense of, and then try to move to having our alternative media be what is turned to get the best understanding of current reality. This is the foundations we're able to set this up with the networks, where the first thing you see is CNN, and he's interviewing a Rhodes Scholar on Parkland, right?
Yeah.
The public is wired from tip to stern to not be able to see the truth. So we have to change that and get them not to when they hear of the event, to actually have an information source that's in real time. And that is happening. More and more I see this. It's like at Parkland, I noticed that a lot of people are wondering why there isn't more iPhone video.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the telltale signs to me. To me, there is like crisis actor behavior. People will point to this, but I think now, it's sort of like the Ariana Grande supposed explosive event. It's an absence of iPhone video that is the most identifying characteristic. If you don't have any of them, if you only have one or two that are shown over and over again, it's always the bald-headed lady. Who comes forth, then, you're in, it's just, it's not a real situation. It's just,
everyone listening to the skinhead lesbian.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the takeaway here is looking at these foundations and under the guise of philanthropy, they're giving to the arts, they're giving to medical institutions, they're giving to colleges, endowing chairs, and they're building libraries, and they're creating scholarships and these things. And if you know how these things work, well, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Everything comes with strings attached. Money always comes with strings attached to it. And if you know anything how the Rhodes Scholarship is going to work, again, it's a way of controlling people's thoughts, of having them internalize the commands of their impressors. And that's the most successful way to maintain an empire, is once people believe that the commands of their oppressors, they take in their own worldview, that's the source of their own enslavement, and then it's easy to rule over them because you've conquered them mentally. And that's what these institutions do. They create a perception of the arts, the way things are. I mentioned how they took over the American Historical Association. They created the American Sociological Association. They created universities. They create entire universities. They can't buy out a university, which they do. Then they build their own, like University of Chicago or Carnegie Mellon or Vanderbilt and these things. And these institutions are used also largely to launder or whitewash their family's history, their criminal past. And that's one thing that they do with their money is, and so they clean up their history. They sort of create a public image. Like I said, it was a PR. I think Rockefeller started his foundation as I think Ivy Lee told him to do it as a PR stunt. Because of some of the bad press, these things. But then again, these things also become incredible, very effective means of more or less creating what they call, what the military call, full spectrum dominance. And yeah. That's what they've done is they can look at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. That's there to degrade, destroy the art. Sort of a debased society for the confused people, because there's that story. I think it was in the bank up there, Chase Manhattan Bank, where they had a Jackson Pollock, where Nelson Rockefeller, bought it, painting of Jackson Pollock. And what they do is they pay money for a piece of modern art crap, and it gets in the newspapers that they paid $1 million for it. and it gets out that Rockefeller's paid $1 million for it, that they can turn around and sell for $2 million.
Sure.
Because it's written up, you know. The same, you know. At the same time, they create something like art, which is there to uplift the people, to edify people. But they can use it in reverse, to degrade people. They do that with modern art. But there's a story he hung up a painting, I think it was a Jackson Pollock painting, in the lobby of Chase Manhattan Bank, and for years it was upside down and no one knew it.
Right, well, what difference does it make? I mean, the thing with Jackson Pollock, he's a really great example because, you know, I mean, it's just scribbles and basically paint bombs thrown against the canvas. Yeah. It's almost like he's laughing at the public. But look in to what he's trying to destroy. I mean, why would you want to, you know, have this as art? Well, it's because art was something else. Art was, like you say, it was to edify, but basically it was, an elevated form of communication. And it had as one of its purposes to improve the thinking, you know, and the spirituality of the people who were actually, you know, in the presence of the art object. And so when you replace that with the theater of the absurd, with pornography and Jackson Pollock, you've really taken the people into a debased state. I was at the Guggenheim a little while ago and saw a Chagall exhibition. And I mean, it just made me sick to my stomach. And I thought, you know, I should really begin a career as an art critic, because I had exactly the right response to that garbage. It should make you just ill, because it's, you know, it's not there. These paintings of, you know, things, you know, kind of, I mean, I kind of get Chagall's symbolism, at least I think I do, and it's very, very sinister, but it's put in a, you know, in the context of like a little three-year-old sort of hand drawing kind of thing. And then people are sitting there going out, it's just wonderful. It's very much like Jackson Pollock. It's like, yeah, this pack of squiggles is so much better than the pack of squiggles he did last week. You know, he's got blue squiggles as well as red squiggles, you know, and it's just, this is just ludicrous. The right, you know, approach to that stuff is to burn it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would like, you know, an art critic to walk up to a Pollock, throw a gallon of gasoline, light it a fire, and say, well, the painting is improved now. This is collaborative art. And just try to justify it on that ground.
Yeah, you know? it's an act of performance art.
It was performance art. Yeah. I mean, certainly Jackson would understand this.
Like Yoko Ono's art or something.
Yeah. So, you know, so it's in the future, the funding of the, you know, culturally destructive is going to be passed along to corporations, because they can put out the research and no one can contest them. I think when you look at, you know, like Tesla and the self-driving car, which incidentally, I hate to say it, but I might buy one if they ever come out, just because I hate driving. But I would do it with the awareness, you know, that this is a bad social trend. You don't want to let, you know, the grid have control over your movement. But at the same time, you know, they're going to try to sell convenience and, mm-hmm. When you get on in years and, you know, it's the only way you can get around, I think they're really going to have a great product there. And I'm afraid of what the, you know, impact is going to be. But in any case, you know, we need to try to get the foundations to be seen in the correct historical context as destroyers of civilization and as the precursors to slavery. And when we do that, then we can see more clearly the descendants of the foundation, the pseudo corporations that I think are now, you know, going to these gigantic worldwide corporations, you know, that are conglomerates. And of course, they'll have foundations on the other side. They'll probably always, you know, like when you look at, you know, the huge media conglomerates. They'll have a foundation that they can use to, you know, disperse money to in ways that they think it's more appropriate than trying to do it as the funding of an experiment or for business purposes. But, you know, it all goes to the same place, and no one should be fooled by any of that.
Yeah. Tonight we didn't mention the Clinton Foundation, but the corruption there is just so audacious and so obvious that it didn't really serve our purposes tonight, because we're talking about the more subtle approach that the foundation has used. Clinton Foundation is just in your face. It's like utter graft and corruption.
It is. It's just there's nothing there. But you know, the nice thing is that it helps clarify the earlier foundations.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you can see that because obviously the Clintons are inside the secret society. And so they're just this is their representation of what they understand about the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, you know, and they're just doing their little Arkansas version. Mm-hmm. And it's just 100% cesspool. You know, so
typically no class.
No class, buddy.
So, well, Joe, I think we covered it.
I think we got it, Tim.
Yeah, good. Okay, well.
Expose the foundations, and thank you so very much.
Okay, great. We'll talk next week then.
Talk next week for sure. Thank you.
Take care. Bye bye. Thank you.